Shalom, Hadavarnex. We're ready to begin our class again on the First Regathering, Modern Israel. We're going to pick it up on session number 36. That'll be page 284 in your notebook, page 284. Before, of course, we get into the new material, let's go ahead and do a quick review of where we were when we left off. Last time we took a look at the progress made in the land of Israel from 1948 to 1998, and that progress was summarized on this chart dealing with total population, military equipment, and economic gains. But the most important statistic, I believe, on this chart is the very last statistic at the bottom of the page, Native Israelis. Notice that in 1948, Sabras only made up 26.3% of the total population, while in 1998, Sabras made up 61.2% of the total population. So Israel was growing in stability and growing in its population, as well as growing economically. Now, along with that growing population also came a growing cultural war, culture clash. And that culture clash was between the ultra-Orthodox, which make up about 10 to 15% of the population, and the secular Israelis, which make up around 85% of the population. Here, this picture shows a confrontation over a Shabbat demonstration. This Orthodox man, I believe, was part of the protest, protesting people, businesses being open on Shabbat, on Saturday. And you can see the secular policeman has him almost by the throat there. Believe me, there's no love lost between those two individuals. Here's another example of the culture clash. Again, another Orthodox man protesting. I believe it was that Intel allowed its workers to work on Shabbat. He's being taken off to jail, but much more gently, it looks in that picture. The Y River Memorandum was also signed during this time. You can see on the left Yasser Arafat affixing his signature to the memorandum. Next to him is King Hussein of Jordan. And King Hussein of Jordan is undergoing chemotherapy during this time. You can see the effect of the chemotherapy upon his body. He would die soon after the Y River Memorandum of Cancer. Next to him is Bill Clinton, President Bill Clinton of the United States, and then Prime Minister Netanyahu of the State of Israel. The culture clash also extended to the believers in Jesus. There was quite a bit of persecution going on against the believers, especially in Beersheba, and that harassment has continued. And this picture is a similar mob scene outside the Beersheba congregation, but now this is in 2005, so it's a number of years beyond where we were last time. But just to show you that the harassment continues. We talked about the Galilee Experience. They produce a multimedia slideshow about the history of the Galilee. And during that slideshow, they spend a few minutes on the life of Jesus. And the Orthodox hate that and have tried to get the Galilee Experience closed down for many, many years. And the Galilee Experience is located on the shores of the Sea of Galilee in this building. So if you go to Israel, please go to the Galilee Experience. And they have a good, nice gift shop, and they also have a fascinating slideshow on the history of the Galilee. Well worth going to. King Hussein of Jordan then died, and here you can see this picture of the king in happier and healthier times. He was succeeded by his son, Prince Abdullah. So now Abdullah is the current king of the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, King Abdullah. Then the Sharm el-Sheikh Memorandum was signed. Remember, it's part of Oslo II, the Oslo Accords, the Interim Agreement, which is a comprehensive agreement on the transfer of powers and responsibilities in the West Bank and Israel to an elected Palestinian council, as follows. The Sharm el-Sheikh Memorandum dealt with a release of prisoners. It dealt with further redeployment of the IDF troops, safe passage between Gaza and the West Bank. President Johannes Rau of Germany also visited Israel, and it was a significant meeting because he offered an official apology by the German government to the Jewish people and to the Israelis. He also visited Yad Vashem during his time in Israel, so we took a little bit of a side trip through Yad Vashem. Here's the Hall of the Names, where the Holocaust Museum is trying to collect all the names of every Jewish person that was lost in the Holocaust, and the Hall of Remembrance, a sacred area that is actually a graveyard, because ashes from the Holocaust, from the death camps, are placed in this building. Pope John Paul II visited Israel as well during this time, and that brings us up to page 284 in your notes. The U.S. backs the Lebanon pullout plan. Prime Minister Ehud Barak announced that he would want to withdraw the Israeli Defense Forces from southern Lebanon by July of 2000, and the Clinton administration welcomed that move. U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright praised the decision to withdraw, and in response to criticism from the Arab state, said, "It's strange that a country is criticized for withdrawing from another country." If you'll remember, the Arab state said, "We don't want you occupying Lebanon." And as soon as Israel said, "Okay, we'll get out," then they criticized Israel and said that could lead to war. Kind of crazy, reasoning. It's not so crazy when you want to damn Israel for what it does and damn Israel for what it doesn't. But that's the Arab understanding. Now, 9 basic understandings were reached regarding this pullout plan. Number 1, that Israel would ensure the Palestinians get contiguous territory in the West Bank in return for territories annexed to the State of Israel. Secondly, Barak will accelerate the talks on the Palestinian track in an attempt to finalize a framework agreement by May and include the third pullback in it. The United States will increase its involvement in the process, and American representatives will sit in on the talks between the Israelis and the Palestinians, and that'll continue outside of Washington. Fourthly, Canada will get involved. Canada will lead an international effort to help meet the needs of the Palestinian refugees. Israel will contribute money but will not take in any refugees. Fifthly, Israel will withdraw from Lebanon to a line set by the United Nations in 1978 and will not leave any outpost or security fences on the Lebanese side of the border. They will totally withdraw. Sixthly, the United States will help muster international support for the implementation of UN Resolution 425 that dealt with the withdrawal from Lebanon, and put pressure on Syria to prevent terrorism after the pullback. Seventh understanding, the Syrian track will remain on hold waiting further developments, and the United States is suspending its mediation efforts. Eighth, the United States will try to convince Russia to stop the flow of technology to Iran. So here we see, way back in 2000, Russia was already beginning to make overtures to Iran and become more closely aligned with them. 9, Israel and the United States will continue consultations in attempts to solve the dispute over the sale of planes to China. So you can read more about the details of the pullout plan on page 285. So let's turn now to page 286 in your notebook. And at the top of the page, Hezbollah harassment has begun. As the Israelis, as the IDF, started to put together its plans to pull out of Lebanon, Hezbollah began to harass them. Hezbollah fire aimed at IDF bases is no accident. All the evidence suggests that the Katyusha fire yesterday was part of a Hezbollah military campaign to harass the IDF as it withdraws from southern Lebanon. And this came from Haaretz daily newspaper, I believe. It's reasonable to expect that the pullout will be conducted amid Hezbollah attacks so that the IDF, and this is the key, so that the IDF will be made to appear as though it is retreating under fire. See, then Hezbollah could claim, we beat Israel, we drove them out. That was the propaganda value they planned to reap from harassing the Israeli troops when they decided to pull back. May 1st, 2000, permanent status talks resume, dealing with the permanent status issues. You can read more about that in your on page 286. On page 287 of your notebook, on May 5th, 2000, the northern border continues to heat up and flare up with harassment from Hezbollah. May 9th, 2000, the population of Israel numbers 6.3 million. Israel's population on its 52nd Independence Day is 6.3 million compared to 6.0 million last year, almost exactly 6 million the year before. Some 4.9 million citizens are Jews and 1.1 million are Arabs. That leaves 0.3% or are other minorities in the land. So there's more details on page 287. Now let's move down to the next heading at the bottom of page 287. May 15th, 2000, the Nakba catastrophe violence. Here I'd like to read some paragraphs from Israel My Glory, the magazine Israel My Glory, dealing with an explanation of Nakba. This comes from the August-September issue of 2000 on page 4. They write in Israel My Glory, Israelis had observed their annual Independence Day celebration 52 years as a sovereign nation. In response, Yasser Arafat's Fatah organization announced a special day of its own. It was dubbed Nakba Day, Day of Catastrophe. So this is a very deliberate celebration day set up in the year 2000. The catastrophe referred to was the day Israel officially joined the international community as a nation on May 14, 1948. To commemorate Nakba Day, Arafat ordered demonstrations that resulted in Palestinian rock throwing, Molotov cocktail showers, and Palestinian police firefights with Israeli police and military. In the end, several lay dead and more than 350 were injured. Now here is a current picture of a current demonstration on Nakba Day. And you see this young lady in the center is holding up a key. And that key has become a major symbol of Nakba because it represents, quote, the keys to our homes that the Jews stole. And we are going to come back and we have our keys with us and we are going to reclaim our homes. That is the idea behind the key. Now here's another picture of a mural painted on the side of a wall, and again the major element in that mural is the key in the Palestinians' hands, saying, we will return, we have the keys to our homes, and we will be back. All right, you can read more about the Nakba violence in 2000 on page 288, but let's move now to page 289, top of page 289. May 16th, 2000, a very interesting event happened. The PA arrested Israel's public enemy number one. So the PA was doing a little bit of its part to fulfill its agreements. Jerusalem. A Palestinian militant suspected of having masterminded some of the bloodiest terror attacks against Israel in recent years has been taken into custody by Yasser Arafat's Palestinian Authority, according to Israeli and Palestinian sources. Mohammed Dieff, and here is Mr. Mohammed Dieff. He is widely regarded in Israel as public enemy number one. He was arrested or gave himself up this month in the Gaza Strip, where he has been a fugitive since his alleged role in a spree of suicide bombings in early 1996. May 23rd, 2000, toward the bottom of the page. The IDF withdraws from Lebanon, the SLA collapses. The SLA is the South Lebanese Army. Israel's 18-year-long military presence in Lebanon came to an end on Tuesday, May 23, 2000, as the sudden collapse of the South Lebanon Army forced the IDF to conduct a hasty retreat from outposts throughout the security zone. And there's more details on that event on the next few pages. You can read about that on page 290, but let's move ahead to page 291. And we'll move ahead to May 30th, 2000. On May 30th, 2000, Israel was accepted in a UN regional group. But let me read about that to you. The chief U.S. delegate in the United Nations, Richard Holbrooke, hailed Israel's acceptance as a temporary member of a UN regional group, opening the way for the country's eventual election to UN bodies. Notice the last phrase, after being barred for more than 40 years. So on one hand, the United Nations votes Israel into the organization, and then on the other hand, they bar them from having any substantial input into the organization. That's the hypocrisy of the UN. Mr. Holbrooke continued, "It is an historic step forward in the elimination of a huge injustice," Mr. Holbrooke said. It just goes to show that the UN is emerging into a new, I hope, post-ideological phase of its existence where issues are dealt with on their merits. Well, I believe his hope has not come to pass. The UN here in 2014 seems to be as ideological as ever. Israel, now, but no, here's a, this next sentence is a mark it up moment. Israel, with its acceptance as a full temporary member of the West European and Others group, was the only member barred from the UN's five regional groupings. And so that hypocrisy by the UN continues up to this day. Nothing really has changed. All right, let's take a look at the bottom of page 291. July 2000, Camp David talks. Mideast peace talks between Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, U.S. President Bill Clinton, and Yasser Arafat collapsed on July 26 after 2 weeks of negotiations. And here is a photograph of the three leaders involved in the Camp David peace talks in July 2000. Ehud Barak on your left, Bill Clinton in the center, and Yasser Arafat on the right. Well, how did it go? How did these Camp David talks go? Well, both sides knew it was an all-or-nothing situation. If the summit is a dead end, there will be war, a senior Israeli military official predicted. Robert Malley, Clinton's staffer, shared the reason why the president went to Camp David, and this is a big mark-it-up moment. This next sentence, "The reason why we went to Camp David was that we had every indication that by September the Intifada was going to happen." All right, the battle for Jerusalem, the Intifada, was pre-planned by Arafat before the Camp David summit. The media didn't handle it that way, but everybody knew it had been pre-planned. We're on page 292, below the picture of the three presidents. Participants agree that Clinton did a masterful job of negotiation and possessed a stunning knowledge of Jerusalem. However, Arafat kept pulling out new demands, and in the end, there wasn't any version that Arafat was prepared to accept. Arafat made the decision to reject any all-embracing agreement. However, he was promised orally 96% of the West Bank. And this map is a map of the Israeli proposal at Camp David 2000. The Israeli territory is the yellow areas. The yellow areas, there's a little bit of area on the west side of the West Bank, then a corridor through to the Jordan Valley, and then in the southern part of the West Bank, there's Israeli territory around Jerusalem, the city of Jerusalem, with a corridor again down to the Jordan Valley. And the green area, both light green and dark green, is the Palestinian territory. The Palestinian territory, again, 96% of the West Bank. Now, the offer included incredibly far-reaching proposals besides the forfeiture of the West Bank. Barak was willing to divide Jerusalem and to allow Arafat to proclaim the capital of his independent state in Jerusalem. And now here is a map of the Israeli proposal for Jerusalem, close-up of Jerusalem, and you can see the Israeli territory is divided. We have the yellow is Israeli territory, and that would be East Jerusalem, but you see right through the middle of it runs the green area, the dark green area. Well, that would be the Palestinian areas of Jerusalem. So Jerusalem would be a divided city under Barak's plan, under his proposal. Palestinian control would have extended over the Muslim and Christian quarters of Jerusalem, including the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Palestinian control, but not sovereignty, would have been granted over the Temple Mount. Now, Arafat never offered a counter-proposal. He just turned it down. Now, this behavior incensed President Clinton. Upon his return to Gaza, Arafat began speaking in inflammatory terms in Arabic about taking Jerusalem while talking peace in English. And this was very typical of Arafat. In Arabic, he would stir things up. But in English, he would talk peace. A very duplicitous man. I'm not sure I said that word right. And it was the Intifada that was fueled by such rhetoric. Now, on page 93, we have an article that was written in October 4th, 2002 and appeared in the Jerusalem Post, and it confirms that the Intifada was a pre-planned event by Arafat. So let's take a look at this. It's a chronology of Palestinian moves leading up to the outbreak of violence 2 years ago, and it shows it was planned in advance and ignited over the Jerusalem issue. So on page 293, a few days after the failure of the Camp David summit in July 2000, the Palestinian Authority's monthly magazine Al-Shuhada, the Martyrs, published the following letter on July 25th. From the negotiating delegations at Camp David, led by the commander and symbol Abu Ammar, that's Yasser Arafat, to the brave Palestinian people, be prepared, the battle for Jerusalem has begun. The letter appeared in the aftermath of reports emanating from Camp David suggesting that the summit had failed because of Arafat's intransigence. According to PA sources, the letter was written by a senior Arafat advisor and approved by the PA chairman beforehand. The letter was published in a magazine distributed only among PA security personnel. It did not appear in any of the daily newspapers published in Jerusalem or Ramallah. Hence, the message Arafat was sending to his armed men was clear: be prepared for an all-out confrontation with Israel because I refuse to accept Israeli and American dictates. In other words, I'm going to cause this thing to fail, and then we're going to start our intifada. As the Camp David summit was underway, Arafat's Fatah organization, the biggest faction of the PLO, started training Palestinian teenagers for the upcoming violence in 40 training camps throughout the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. PA appointed imams in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip mosques, began referring to Israel as the Zionist enemy, and urged all Muslims to mobilize for the war against the infidels. In the words of one Gazan preacher, all weapons must be aimed at the Jews, at the enemies of Allah, the cursed nation of the Quran, whom the Quran describes as monkeys and pigs, worshippers of the calf and idol worshippers. Other imams spoke of the need and duty to liberate Palestine from the Zionist aggressors. This time, the talk was not only about liberating the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Now the demand was for Jerusalem, Jaffa, Haifa, and Ashkelon. Israel was also accused of distributing drugs among young Palestinian men and women in order to corrupt them and bring about the disintegration of Palestinian society. In addition to the drugs, the Israelis were also believed to be behind sexually arousing chewing gum found in Palestinian shops. Now, why in the world would Israel do something like that? Well, the alleged goal? To turn Palestinian women into prostitutes. And these kinds of far-out crazy accusations continue even to today. As the tensions intensified, PA officials this time accused Israel of spreading radioactive belts that cause cancer. An August 3rd poll conducted by the Independent Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research indicated that two-thirds, that's 66%, two-thirds of the Palestinians supported a new intifada against Israel. It was the first time since the signing of the Oslo Accords that a majority of Palestinians said they supported violence against Israel. All right, page 294, middle of the page, July 25th, 2000, UN announces the completion of the Israeli withdrawal from Lebanon. So Israel followed through on Barak's desire to get out of Lebanon, and it was finished July 25, 2000. You can read more details on that in your notebook. We'll move to the bottom of the page, and September 28, 2000. September 28, Likud Chairman Ariel Sharon visits the Temple Mount. Ariel Sharon announced his plans to visit the Temple Mount on the eve of Rosh Hashanah, a few days in advance of the visit. Israeli intelligence gathering resources had been informed. They determined that Ariel Sharon's visit to the Temple Mount would not generate unrest or disturbances. Public Security Minister Shlomo Ben Ami coordinated the visit with Yabril Rajoub, the head of the PA Preventive Security Forces. Moving on to page 95. Rajoub told Ben Ami that if Sharon did not enter the mosques, there was no reason for concern. Sharon would state later that he never intended to enter Al-Aqsa Mosque or the Dome of the Rock. Security considerations had been examined with the conclusion that there was no reason to prevent the Likud chairman from visiting the site. Mr. Sharon toured the Temple Mount surrounded by over 1,000 security troops. Quite an entourage. Here's a picture of Ariel Sharon. Here he is at the Western Wall. And you can see one of his security guards in the foreground. And after visiting the Western Wall, he went up to the Temple Mount and walked around up there with an entourage of 1,000 security personnel. All right, page 295. Al-Aqsa Intifada begins, also known as the Battle for Jerusalem. Just after Sharon left the compound, a demonstration ensued with 25 Israeli policemen and four Muslim rioters injured. In a frank admission, one WAF official, now the WAF is the Muslim organization that's given the responsibility of controlling and managing the Temple Mount. One WAF official later described the rioters as those who came here to cause trouble and not to pray. The demonstrations quickly spread to Judea, Samaria, and Gaza. IDF outposts and Israeli civilians came under attack from stone-throwing youths, armed Tanzim, we'll talk about the Tanzim in a few minutes, and even PA security forces. The U.S. State Department blamed the violence on Sharon's visit. The French government issued a statement condemning the visit as a deliberate provocation. See how this is being handled? Sharon, and I must add rightly so, Sharon rejected the accusation, stating, "The disturbances are part of an overall premeditated campaign, which began 10 days ago near Netzarim and spread from there to Jerusalem, Judea, and Samaria." It was a pre-planned intifada. Sharon asserted that any Israeli has the right to visit the Temple Mount. He publicly stated that any Arab could visit Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Memorial, without permission. And may I add, for that matter, any German person can visit Yad Vashem. Israeli analysts felt that Palestinian extremists had been looking for any excuse to initiate hostilities over Al-Aqsa, and that's a key sentence. Sharon was the match, but there was already gasoline poured all over the situation, he stated. Now, the next sentence is a mark-it-up moment, a very important sentence. The Mitchell Report of May 4, 2001 would state that its investigations determined that the riots, note, did not break out as a result of Ariel Sharon's visit to the Temple Mount. That was just the excuse. Now, the two sides seem close to a ceasefire on Saturday when a tragic event ignited the flames even further. In Gaza on Saturday, a French TV crew filmed an Arab man and his frightened 12-year-old son, Rami Abdoura, caught in a crossfire. They were huddling behind a small stone wall. The boy was hit and died in his father's arms, and the father was also wounded and in shock. And here are a couple of slides from that presentation. You can see the stone wall on the right side, and Rami Abdoura being pushed against the wall by his father there on the left of the picture. And then the filming ended up with supposedly the boy being killed and the father being wounded. These are the images that went out to the Arab world. An initial, this is on page 296 now, move to page 296, an initial IDF review of the footage concluded that the two were likely hit by IDF fire, but noted that the Israeli forces could not directly see the pair. The IDF was returning fire on a Palestinian machine gun nest immediately behind them. A thorough IDF investigation issued 3 weeks later and confirmed, by a German TV crew showed that the bullets that hit the boy came from the direction of Palestinian gunmen who had attacked the Israeli guard post. Nevertheless, the tragedy inflamed the Palestinians and also Israeli Arabs who took to the streets as well. There were riots in Jaffa, Haifa, and Nazareth. These internal riots stunned the Israeli police by their size and intensity. Israeli sources claim that Arafat met on Friday, the day before, at his Ramallah office with the leaders of the Tanzim, the Fatah's youth paramilitary group. The Tanzim are led by Marwan Barghouti, and here is our good friend Marwan Barghouti, the Tanzim leader. Remember, this is a youth paramilitary group. Those present were given to understand by Arafat that there was a need to continue the disturbances in a way that would result in a significant number of fatalities, both among Israelis and Palestinians. At the same time, Arafat promised Prime Minister Ehud Barak that he would act in order to return calm to the streets. So again, notice an example of Arafat's duplicity. On one hand, he's telling his youth paramilitary group, we've got to increase fatalities. And on the other hand, he's promising to bring peace. That was Yasser Arafat. All right, page 296 through page 297, we have an article on called Retrospective from the International Jerusalem Post, dealing with all this, October 1st, 2002. Then on page 297, you have an article from Wikipedia on the Tanzim, and you can read that for yourself. So that now brings us to page 298, and I think it's time for our break. So let's go ahead and take your break and come back when we're ready to, when the break is over. Okay, let's pick it up where we left off. We're now on page 298 of your notebook, and the media bias evident is the heading we're looking at, media bias evident on page 298, because the way some of these demonstrations against Israel are recorded by the media is absolutely biased and unbalanced. And it was especially true during the Intifada, and this is probably the grossest media propaganda that occurred. So let's take a look at the middle of page 298. On the day the Intifada broke out, Tuvia Grossman was riding in a taxi to visit the Western Wall. He was unwittingly thrust into the international limelight and nearly killed in the process. September 30th, 2000, New York Times, Associated Press, and other major media outlets published the photo of a young man, bloodied and battered, crouching beneath a club-wielding Israeli policeman. The caption identified him as a Palestinian victim of the recent riots, with the clear implication that the Israeli soldier was the one who beat him. And here's the article that appeared in the Times, the New York Times. And the reproduced the caption there, an Israeli policeman and a Palestinian on the Temple Mount. Now I'd like you to notice in the background, you see some Hebrew lettering, and you also see a gas station sign, an Israeli gas station sign. Please notice those items, okay? Alrighty. Here's another picture of Tuvia Grossman, the poor young man who was attacked. The victim's true identity was revealed later when Dr. Aaron Grossman of Chicago sent the following letter to the Times. Quote, regarding your picture on page A5 of the Israeli soldier and the Palestinian on the Temple Mount, that Palestinian was actually my son, Tuvia Grossman, a Jewish student from Chicago. He and two of his friends were pulled from their taxi cab while traveling in Jerusalem by a mob of Palestinian Arabs and severely beaten and stabbed. That picture could not have been taken on the Temple Mount because there are no gas stations. Because there are no gas stations on the Temple Mount, and certainly none with Hebrew lettering, like the one clearly seen behind the Israeli soldier attempting to protect my son from the mob. Folks, I have been up on the Temple Mount a number of times, and you can believe my eyewitness testimony, there are no gas stations up on the Temple Mount, like the one behind the Israeli policeman. In fact, here is a picture of the Temple Mount. Now, can you see any gas stations there? You see any gas stations there? Hidden in the trees, perhaps? No. Let me assure you, there are no gas stations on the Temple Mount. In response, the New York Times published a half-hearted correction which identified Tuvia Grossman as an American student in Israel, not as a Jew who was beaten by Arabs. The correction also noted that Mr. Grossman was wounded in Jerusalem's Old City, although the beating actually occurred in an Arab neighborhood, the Wadi al-Yaz, not in the Old City. In response to public outrage at the original error and the inadequate correction, the New York Times reprinted Tuvia Grossman's picture, this time with the proper caption, along with a full article detailing his near lynching at the hands of Palestinian rioters. So, a gross example of the anti-Israel bias in the media, and anti-Israel bias that extends even to today in 2014, some 14 years later. All right, page 299, October 12, 2000, two Israeli reservists lynched. Two IDF reserve soldiers, Corporal Vadim Novoshesk and Sergeant Major Yosef Avrahami, took a wrong turn as they headed toward their military base near Beit El, near Ramallah. They were stopped at a PA roadblock. In the past, police have simply turned back Israeli soldiers who lost their way. Instead, the Palestinians arrested the Israelis at gunpoint and ordered them to drive to the Ramallah police station. After arriving at the station, word got out that the Palestinian police were holding several Israeli soldiers. The rumor included the false information that they may be part of an undercover unit designed to hunt Palestinian fugitives. The men were not in uniform, but that is not unusual for reserve soldiers, who usually get their uniforms at the base. The IDF got word of the problem and immediately contacted PA liaison officials, asking that the soldiers be urgently rescued. By then, an angry mob of more than 1,000 Palestinians had surrounded the police station. Palestinian witnesses say police tried to hold back the crowd and that 15 PA officers were hurt in the melee. About a dozen men climbed into the police station through a window, and a few minutes later, gunshots were heard. Two men then appeared at the window, sticking their bloody hands out. And there's the photograph. It was recorded. There's this young man with bloody hands, proudly displaying them to the monsters in the crowd below. One monster cheering other monsters, or being cheered by other monsters. That's the picture. Footage from the Italian Mediaset TV channel showed one of the soldiers dangling upside down from a rope from a window, and the body was then dropped into the crowd below. And here's the picture that went around of that event. Here's this this corpse being tossed out the window on a rope. The crowd then attacked the body and then dragged it to the streets. The second soldier was thrown out the door. The two bodies were later handed over to the army. Page 300 of your notes. That day, Israel used attack helicopters for the first time to attack Palestinian Authority installations. By the end of June, 15 Palestinian suspects had been arrested for involvement in the lynching. Aziz Salha, 20 years old, was in custody. He had been seen waving bloodied hands from the police station window. Unfortunately, the brutality of the lynching surfaced in the midst of the Jerusalem police force in May. So this, unfortunately, the same sort of brutality does raise its ugly head in the Israeli police departments as well. And there was another example of this. On May 7th, Jerusalem policemen, including one officer, were indicted for beating a man taken in by the army as a suspect in the Ramallah lynching. The policemen beat the prisoner because they thought he was the one filmed with the blood on his hands. In October, the Italian television station apologized to the PA for filming the lynching. The footage aired on several stations around the world, and the PA had threatened the life of the Italian crew members, the filming crew. They didn't want this to get out. This story was all over the news. And there's the issue of U.S. News and World Report. I subscribed to that magazine at that time. And you can see this is the picture of summarized the Intifada. Aziz Salha, 20 years old, with his bloodied hands at the window. All right, the middle of the page, October 16th. The year 2000, the Sharm el-Sheikh summit. U.S. President Bill Clinton, Egyptian President Mubarak, Israeli Minister Barak, and PA Chairman Yasser Arafat began an emergency summit meeting at Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt. The summit was a contentious 28-hour failure. Mr. Barak and Arafat never negotiated directly. They did shake hands and sit in a civil manner during the sessions and at meals. However, they negotiated through Mr. Mubarak and through Mr. Clinton. Before the summit, Barak expressed strong doubts that Arafat was still interested in reaching a peace agreement. Quote, "He launched a wave of violence in the last few weeks when it was clear that there is on the table a possible framework agreement which reflects further flexibility of Israelis. That even in the past, and he chose not to go for it." The summit closed with a statement read by President Clinton announcing that both sides had agreed on two major items. One, to end the violence, and two, to set up an international fact-finding committee into the cause of the violence. Prime Minister Barak said that the true test of Sharm el-Sheikh conference would be whether the violence ends. Page 301. The ceasefire was only 1 hour old, and senior Palestinian Authority officials were leading several hundred chanting protesters on a march through Ramallah to protest the agreement. So it really has a great chance of being implemented, doesn't it? Marwan Barghouti was adamant that the Al-Aqsa Intifada would continue. And from there, it only got worse. A protracted firefight broke out in the West Bank after Palestinian militants opened fire on Israeli settler families out on a Sukkot holiday hike. In June 2001, Clinton blamed Arafat for the failure of the peace process. Clinton stated that 3 days prior to the end of his presidency, Arafat called him to say goodbye. He told me I was a great man. I told him I wasn't, that I was a gigantic failure and that it was his fault. Clinton described Arafat as an aging leader who is incapable of making the right decision to commit himself to the peace process. Clinton later shared that at Camp David, he told Arafat that by turning down the best peace deal he was ever going to get, he was guaranteeing the election of hawkish Ariel Sharon. And Clinton was very, very right. Page 301, the youthful face of the Intifada. The young men of the Tanzim are at the forefront of the Al-Aqsa Intifada. Again, remember, it's also known as the Battle for Jerusalem. Even as Palestinian officials accuse Israel of overreacting to peaceful protests, they are encouraging and facilitating youthful participation. Why? The televised pictures of 13, 14, and 15-year-olds carried off the battlefield, bloodied and unconscious, is a powerful public relations weapon. Arafat called for renewed resistance by the young activists. Often the children go straight from school to the site of the demonstration. In Ramallah, a man raced toward a line of Israeli soldiers shouting, Allah Akbar, God is great, while holding in front of him a boy about 2 years old. The child's head was wrapped in a green Hamas kerchief inscribed with the words, There is no God but Allah. According to traditional Islamic belief, a shaheed, a martyr for the faith, will receive 72 virgins as wives in heaven. There is a mystical belief that Allah favors the martyr. Women are not excluded from this action. The PA's leading official newspaper is Al-Hayat al-Yadiha. The editor-in-chief wrote a signed editorial denouncing as corrupt and disgusting anyone who counsels self-preservation to Palestinian youth, including their own fathers. So if you are a Palestinian and you say to a young Palestinian boy, don't get yourself in the line of fire, don't get killed over this, you are corrupt and disgusting, even if that young Palestinian boy is your son. Amazing. This situation is very disturbing to Israeli soldiers. Sergeant Hillel Gubenko, himself only 19, stated, you kind of feel frustrated when children are throwing rocks. You don't want to shoot them, but people hiding behind them are shooting at you. Page 302. Speaking to an Egyptian newspaper, the Arafat appointed Mufti of Jerusalem and Palestine, Sheikh Ikrima Sabri, stated, question, what do you feel when you pray for the soul of the martyrs? Sabri, I feel the martyr is lucky because the angels usher him into his wedding in heaven. I feel the earth moves under the occupier's feet. Question, is it different when the martyr is a child? Sabri, yes it is. It's hard to express it in words. There is no doubt that a child martyr suggests that the new generation will carry on the mission with determination. The younger the martyr, the greater and more respect, the greater and more, and the more I respect him. I talked to a young man who said, I want to marry the black-eyed, that means beautiful, the black-eyed beautiful women of heaven. The next day he became a martyr. I am sure his mother is filled with joy about this heavenly marriage. Such a son must have such a mother." End quote. In May 2001, the American Academy of Pediatrics issued a statement denouncing the Palestinians for using their children as human shields. The statement was initiated by a group of 200 doctors called Doctors Against Child Sacrifice. Now, the tragedy of hatred was emphasized during mid-2002 when the photo of a baby bomber was discovered at the home of a suspected terrorist. The toddler was photographed in a mock suicide bomber's uniform, complete with sticks of explosives and the traditional martyr's red headband. And here is the photograph of this little toddler, this little boy, in his little uniform that his parents put on him. He, of course, doesn't know what's going on. He's too young. But that's their hope for him, that he would be a martyr. The family stated that the photograph was a joke. It was a prank. Yeah. But the photograph emphasizes how pervasively the Palestinians are training their children to hate Israelis and Israel. The Shahid, the martyr, has become a prominent role model for young men in Palestinian society. Palestinian minister, Labor Minister Ghassan Khatib stated that the IDF distributed the picture to tell the world that the Palestinians are teaching their children how to hate Israel and how to act against Israel. And I just want to say, this is correct. This is correct. That's what we are doing, he admits. A Palestinian journalist in Hebron said that this kind of photograph was common because many of their children imitate the adults. One other Palestinian officials dismissed the photo as a propaganda trick. And here is a poster that was created over the idea. Notice the top, it says, "Islam is peace. Potential. Not everyone gets to be an astronaut when they grow up," is the little line under the word potential. "Not everyone gets to be an astronaut when they grow up, if they grow up." And here's a mom outfitting her young son with an explosive belt, or at least the model of an explosive belt. Islam is peace, the peaceful religion of Islam. Palestinian school books are likewise geared to fan the flames of hatred. Israel examined 23 school books intended for children in first and second grade, as well as fifth and sixth grade. The books delegitimize Israel and claim that the Palestinians have first rights to the territory. They claim that Arab Canaanites were in the land before the Jews, and therefore Zionistic claims to the land are a lie. Arab Canaanites were in the... Well, are you an Arab or are you a Canaanite? Can't be both, you guys. And the Canaanites are gone. In addition to the heavenly rewards promised the martyrs, there's also financial compensation. Iraq offers $25,000 to the families of terrorists. Saudi Arabia awards families of terrorists $5,000 each when they lose a family member. Finally, according to Israeli sources, Palestinian terrorist recruiters visit terminally ill patients. Say, Mohammed, you're dying of cancer. Why don't you get it over with quick and become a martyr at the same time? Save your family big hospital bills. And by the way, they'll get a little bit of a stipend from Saudi Arabia. Isn't that quite a line, you guys? So Palestinian terrorist recruiters visit terminally ill patients in cancer wards and offer money to their families as well. Probably the most hypocritical position is taken by Yasser Arafat's wife. Arafat's wife, Sulha al-Tawil, has publicly endorsed suicide bombings. In an interview with the London-based, Saudi-owned Al-Mahalla magazine, Mrs. Arafat said, "If she had a son, notice, if she had a son, she would consider it an honor to sacrifice him for the Palestinian cause." Quote, "Would we expect me and my children to be less patriotic and more eager to live than my countrymen and their father and leader who is seeking martyrdom? We're just as patriotic as any other Palestinian," she says. But I want you to note, here she is with her daughter. Mrs. Arafat lives not in Ramallah, not in the Gaza Strip. Mrs. Arafat lives in Paris and Switzerland with her daughter. She has no son. But she's quite willing to boast about how patriotic she was, if she had one. Well, the following comments are not in your workbook, but I think I'll close with these comments. So you can take notes if you'd like, but these are just personal comments that I gained from my trips to Israel. And the comments deal with the idea that the use of children as warriors is not new. Well, how do I know this? The PLO first used children in Lebanon in 1982, when Israel went in against the PLO in Lebanon. That was the first use of children warriors. And again, where did I get this information? Well, I got this information in 2002 when I spent 3 weeks in Israel as a volunteer with the IDF Sarel program. This is the website of Volunteers for Israel, and they are the people who manage the Sarel program. And volunteers can go over and become members of the IDF for 2-3 weeks and help the IDF out. Here is the group I went with. This is a Christian Sarel program, and I'm there in the center under the red circle. So we had a good group of volunteers who went with us for 3 weeks. And this is a picture of me in my IDF uniform with my blue volunteer epaulette on. Those blue and white epaulets signify that you're a volunteer with Sarel. Now, Sarel would give us educational lectures quite often in the evenings. So at one of those evening lectures, a Major Israel delivered the message. And he spoke about his experience in Lebanon in 1982 and the post-traumatic stress syndrome that has dogged him ever since. He lost 11 men. Why did he lose 11 men? Because the PLO used children to launch rockets at the Israeli tanks. Now, in contrast, the IDF pursues a purity of arms doctrine. They do all they can to avoid injuring civilians, both in 1982 and in 2015. It hasn't changed. He stated to us that the anxiety was horrible, because those you try to avoid hurting are killing your men. What would happen? Well, the tanks would rumble along, and the soldiers would see some young children off on the side waving to them, and the soldiers would wave back and smile, and as soon as the tank passed, the children would reach down in and pull a RPG, a rocket-powered grenade, out of hiding and fire it at the tank. Here, you've just waved to these children, and then as soon as your back is turned, they are trying to kill you. So he lost 11 men to that tactic. And then he was severely wounded. He lost an eye, a leg, and he suffered also a severely damaged arm. All he can remember is feeling hot all over his body and then waking up in the hospital. Unfortunately, tragically, his pregnant wife subsequently divorced him, and she told their son after he was born that his father was dead. Gratefully, years later, Major Israel was united with his son. And since his recovery, he has earned 2 college degrees, although he still has a hard time going into crowds and into marketplaces. And a documentary was done on Israeli TV telling his story and his partial recovery. And here is a picture of Major Israel, this man who has been through so much and yet continues to move forward with his life. The man who explained to us when the PLO first began using children as soldiers. All right, that brings us to page 304 in your notebook, and we'll pick this up next week as we look at the response of Israel in November 2000 to this terrorism. So let me pray. Father, we just want to close in prayer and thank you for your oversight of Israel, and thank you for her care. Thank you for the desire that the Israelis have for peace, but we know that true peace will never come to that area until the Prince of Peace rules in everyone's heart. So we pray, Lord, that the believers would continue to face down the opposition to the gospel, to the good news of Jesus the Messiah, and continue to proclaim the good news to Israeli and Arab alike, so that peace may come when you return to the Holy Land. And we ask this in Yeshua's name. Amen. All righty, we'll see you next week.